This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
I am beyond flattered and honored to be here to present some of our work looking at the effects of mindfulness meditation and healthy aging, and also super excited to be able to collaborate with you all to see what kind of good trouble we can get ourselves into. Okay, so as Danielle mentioned, I'll be talking about mindfulness-based mental training to enhance well-being and healthy aging. While I am not necessarily a healthy aging researcher, some of the work that we have done has focused on older adults, and I'm hoping that some of this work that we've conducted will be useful to you. My work and other people's work, of course. So, the main topic of today will be mindfulness. And, you know, a lot of folks know what mindfulness is and it isn't. And a lot of folks think they know what mindfulness is or isn't, including myself. So it is a bit of a nebulous construct. Mindfulness, in its original translation in Pali Sanskrit, is known as that which is to be remembered, i.e. the reflective awareness or skillful attention to remember that your thoughts and emotions are not who you are, that you are to be in the moment to moment without judging yourself or experience. Dr. Jon Kabat-Zinn, who is an MIT-trained biologist, microbiologist, spent a lot of time in the East, and he has been largely responsible for bringing these Eastern practices to the West and doing it in a way that makes it user-friendly and digestible. He characterizes mindfulness as moment-to-moment, non-judgmental awareness cultivated by paying attention in a specific way that is in the present moment and as non-reactive, non-judgmentally, and open-heartedly as possible. That is a mouthful. But he is a beautiful human being. And one of the my teachers as well is Alan Wallace, who founded the Santa Barbara Institute for Consciousness Studies, calls mindfulness non-conceptual awareness that does not label or characterize experiences and involves attending continuously to a familiar object. In many cases, this will be the breath without distraction. And my close colleague and neuroscientist at Carnegie Mellon, David Creswell, says that mindfulness is a process of openly attending with awareness to one's experience in the present moment. As you can see, everyone seemingly has a definition of what mindfulness is. And of course, my definition is the right one. We characterize mindfulness quite simply: awareness of arising sensory events without reaction. And the way that we can really appreciate mindfulness is to practice mindfulness-based meditation or mindfulness-based mental training. So the team here has given me permission to lead you all in a around 10-minute mindfulness meditation practice. And I figured, why not do this together? So if you will, if you don't mind, if you can find yourself a chair that you're comfortably sitting in and sit straight up in your cushion, your chair. You can lay down if you want. That's fine. And I want you to put your feet on the ground, or if you're laying down, don't do that. And gently close your eyes. And what we're going to do is we're going to learn how to practice mindfulness to appreciate what mindfulness is very briefly. And the work that I'm going to be showing you after this practice is all predicated on this type of meditation practice. There's thousands of meditation techniques. This one in particular has been well studied and found to be advantageous for folks across the lifespan. So gently close your eyes, relax, and take a deep breath in, really deep, hold it for a second, and exhale slowly. Perhaps let the exhale be a little bit longer than the inhale. And do this a few times until you start feeling a little bit more comfortable. Inhale in, hold it for a second, and exhale slowly. And by now, you should be feeling a little bit more comfortable. If not, no problem. And now I want you just to breathe normally. Don't change your breathing on purpose. I want you to bring your full concentration and your full awareness to mentally noting the changing sensations of your breathing. Beginning with the breath's inception, occurring at the tips of your nose, I want you to mentally note the cool, tingling air as you breathe in. And the warm, flowing air as you breathe out. Just allow your attention just to settle on the changing sensations of your breathing occurring at the tips of your nose. And by now, perhaps your mind has drifted away from the focus on the breath. Maybe a feeling, thoughts have arisen. What are you going to have for dinner later? A conversation from 10 years ago, or a source of discomfort arises. That's perfectly normal. When this happens, when you become distracted from focusing on the breath, I want you to acknowledge that distracting thought, feeling, and emotion for whatever it is, without judging yourself, without judging the experience. And gently return your attention back to the breath and start the practice over. So let's take a deep breath together. Exhale. And bring your full concentration to mentally noting the changing sensations of your breathing occurring at the tips of the nose. Now you could expand your meditation practice to the full breath, beginning with the tingling sensations of the breathing occurring at the tips of the nose. Follow the breath with your mind's eye down the throat, feeling your chest expand as it fills with air, and then your belly. And then as you begin to exhale, the deflation of your stomach, the fall of your chest, and then following the breath back up until noticing the warm flowing air out of your nose. See if you could focus on one full in-breath and out breath without distraction. And not if, but when you become distracted, acknowledge the distraction without judgment and let it go by returning your attention gently back to the breath to start your practice over. If you find that your mind is too busy, that's great. You're doing it perfectly. You're only realizing how busy your mind is. And the point of this practice is to make you more aware of yourself and the thoughts that go on inside of your mind, as well as your sensory environment, without judgment, evaluation, or reaction. So in the minute that we have left, let's start over together. Take a deep breath and gently attend to your breathing sensations as we finalize our meditation practice. Take a deep breath, and as you exhale, you can begin to gently open your eyes. So welcome back. That was a very brief practice, but should give you a little bit of a flavor of what we're going to be talking about today, about how we can harness our ability to regulate our emotions and thoughts through this practice. By focusing on the breath over and over, what our research has shown is that we enhance this construct called cognitive flexibility, the ability to sustain attention where we intend to sustain our attention, which is critical for us as we get older. The second part of the meditation is acknowledging the distracting thoughts and feelings without judging yourself or the experience. And what we have found in our research is that this is directly related to our ability to regulate emotions, to control our emotions. So mindfulness meditation really engages this 1-2 punch. One, we're enhancing our ability to sustain attention. And two, we're enhancing our ability to regulate our emotions. So how does mindfulness meditation impact the way that we think and process stress? Many years ago, for my dissertation project, we ran an experiment where we tested the effects of a very brief mindfulness meditation intervention. 4 days of training, only 20 minutes a session per training. And people were randomized, i.e. they were randomly assigned to one of two groups. One, the meditation intervention, or two, listening to The Hobbit. Yes, the book, The Hobbit. And we tested several different cognitive assessments and mood. One was called the symbol digit modality test. The other, which I'll talk about, the other is called the controlled oral word association test. This is an exam where we give you a letter like the letter C, and you are to come up with as many words as possible that start with the letter C within 60 minutes. The more words that you can recall within that minute, the better your word associations. And another cognitive task is this one called the computer adaptive NBAC task, which I'm going to talk about here in a second. The symbol digit modality test gives you 90 seconds to place these symbols that correspond to these numbers. So if you see a 5 here, you'd put the sideways T and so on. And you have 90 seconds to correctly complete as many as possible. And this is a measure of working memory, which is a really advanced form of memory that allows you to do kind of math in your head or remember two or three things at the same time. It's also measuring something called visual processing, complex visual processing, the ability to use your vision to integrate into working memory performance. So the more that you completed correctly, the higher the measure of what we call working memory. The other task is called the adaptive NBAC task, and we're going to actually do this together. Well, you're going to do it at home. So this measures executive processing, which is your ability to control thoughts and hold information in your mind for an extended period of time, the ability to process vision and space in the context of memory and working memory. So the idea here is you're supposed to tell me if the letter that you see in front of you is the same or different as two back. And we'll go over that here in a second. And we also measured this construct called the extended hit rate, which means how many you get in a row correct. So first, you're presented with the letter G. And remember, your goal is the one that I see in front of me the same or different as two back? So here's the first one, second one, and the third one, B. You didn't see a B, so the answer should be different. And that would be a correct response. However, if you keep getting a couple in a row correct, then the reason that it became adaptive is because the presentation of each letter became quicker and quicker. So you have to process this information as it's happening to you in real time in a very quick fashion. This is relatively difficult. I did miserable on this task. So for example, G, A, and then if you got B and you say different, that's right. And then the letters start presenting faster. And you have to respond much quicker and quicker and quicker. And that's what we call the extended hit rate. So on our these are the results here. On the y-axis are our responses for the symbol digit modality test. That's the one with the weird symbols and you have to match it with the numbers. And on the x-axis are our groups, the four-day meditation group or listening to The Hobbit for 4 days. The blue characterizes before the interventions, before you did the training or listened to The Hobbit, and the green is afterwards. So it's not like they were meditating, of course, while they were doing these tasks. And what we could see here is that there was a statistically significant improvement in working memory in adults after just 80 minutes of mindfulness meditation training. Now, of course, this group performed a little bit better as well, and we call that from practice effects. They just got better because they did it more than once. But the effects from the mindfulness meditation training were significantly more effective than listening to The Hobbit, which, mind you, many people loved listening to The Hobbit. It made them feel amazing. Now, you recall that assessment where I said, give me how many words start with the letter F or C, and you have to write down as many as you can within 60 seconds. On the y-axis, you could see the responses. The X are the groups. Again, blue is before the intervention and green is after the intervention. And here you could see again, 4 days, 20 minutes a day of training produced enhanced ability to perform working memory and executive processing as a function of the verbal fluency. Now, what about that confusing NBAC task? Here you can see something quite dramatic. This is the extended hit rate. This is the amount that folks got correct in a row. The y-axis are the responses, the x-axis are groups, blue is before the intervention, green is after the intervention. And you could see that this is dramatically different here. And I could tell you that if you're getting about five or six in a row, the stimuli are coming so fast that you could barely even process them. But in the mindfulness meditation group, they were able to do this without much trouble. And this has been arguably my most cited paper of my career. It's in the thousands now. And I think it's because it's really remarkable that we could see changes like this after very brief mental training. If mindfulness meditation after 4 days of training also improved your mood, and what we think happened was that people performed really well on cognitive assessments that were also relatively stressful. In other words, any cognitive assessment that was timed, you had to perform well under the pressure of time. That's really when the mindfulness meditation group outperformed the Hobbit listening group. Other than that, both groups did really well on all of the assessments. So that's the first study that I published as one of my dissertation projects, and it's really stood the test of time to show that you don't need to be a monk to reap the benefits of mindfulness meditation. In mood and the way you feel, which I'll talk about more here in a bit, as well as attentional processing. So then what we did was we asked the question, well, what if it's just a placebo effect? What if there's nothing really special about being mindful and being non-reactive in the present moment? Maybe just taking deep, slow breaths is all you need to do to feel better. So we created this intervention called sham mindfulness meditation. It's a type of meditation, very much so, but it's a different kind of meditation where you're just taught to take slow, deep breaths over and over and over and over again. The mindfulness meditation group, in contrast, focused on the changing sensations of the breath. And when they got distracted, they acknowledged those distractions. They didn't judge themselves. They didn't get caught up in the distraction, and they came back to the breath. And then the control group listened to a book on tape. So here, this was another randomized clinical trial. We measured mood and anxiety before and after the interventions. And so here on the y-axis are the total negative mood scores. On the x-axis, oh, and I apologize, this was only 3 days of training. I moved it to 4 days in a later study. 3 days of training, 20 minutes a day. The black is the breathing meditation. The gray is the mindfulness meditation. And the white is the book listening control. And you could see here that the sham meditation group, the breathing meditation group, did improve in mood, but not as much as the mindfulness meditation. This was about a 70-something percent reduction in negative mood after just 60 minutes of meditation training. And it was more effective than just the breathing meditation. The breathing meditation is going to make you feel good, but there's something really unique about mindfulness meditation that the effects on mood go above and beyond what we would see in just a breathing meditation. Now, just to add some more outcomes here to the results, we see this is on tension, and you could see that the sham technique, the breathing technique, worked, but mindfulness was more effective at reducing tension, more effective at reducing depression. Look how depressed these folks were. This was a dramatic reduction in depression. And the breathing meditation didn't really change it at all. Fatigue, mindfulness meditation made you less fatigued, which is interesting. I'm hopeful that they didn't just sleep and get a nap in and that's why they felt less tired. But in the literature, in the traditional literature, this is a very common report that you get energized from practicing mindfulness meditation, especially after several training sessions. And folks felt less confused after mindfulness meditation as compared to the rest of the groups. In all of these constructs, tension, depression, confusion, and fatigue, mindfulness was more effective than the rest of the control groups, even the breathing intervention. And as you can imagine, as we get older, we get more tired, sometimes can get more tense, sometimes get more confused. So this is a drug-free, free intervention that you could do anytime you want. So this is work that I've done actually in older adults after three sessions of meditation and folks that are older than 65 years. And on the y-axis, this is the percent change in stress after each meditation intervention. You could see just one session almost produced a 60% reduction in stress. And the reason that it's not as pronounced, we think, in session 2 and 3 is because they didn't start out as stressed out after the first intervention. So you could see an immediate benefit in stress relief. And this is in depression after the three sessions. Again, dramatic effects in lowering depression after one 20-minute session. And then after three sessions, honestly, they weren't that depressed after the second. They weren't as dysphoric or sad after the second intervention session. Oh, and folks feel more socially connected. These are self-reported social connection. They feel, as we get older, we also have a tendency to potentially feel more lonely. Folks after mindfulness meditation training felt more socially connected, and we don't actually understand yet why that is. We're working on it. All right, this is the same in stress in older adults, 65, and depression. So what happens in the brain? I am a neuroscientist. I'm not only interested in the effects of mindfulness meditation, but I really care about how it works biologically. For me, this is really the final frontier on understanding how different therapies can work. So my main work, what really pays the bills is my work with chronic pain. And 1 in 10 of us will have chronic low back pain. And especially those of us that are getting older and older, I suffer from several types of chronic pain diseases. And it's just a matter of time, quite frankly, because of the wear and tear that we can put on our bodies through working, through exercising, and just age-related degeneration. So we just finished this experiment. This is only the second time I've shown these results because we just got the results. What we did was we recruited patients with chronic low back pain that had this type of pain called radiculopathy. It's pain that emanates from the back But when you lift someone's leg up, it produces the shooting electrical pain down the leg. And you might be thinking to yourself, A, ouch, B, who would do this? Well, we do pay well. These are study volunteers, and they were very interested. We did have a lot of people that were interested in participating. So here you can see Laura lifting John's leg to evoke his pain. And while we do that, we then image their brains using this technique, this perfusion MRI technique, where we can see changes in blood flow, i.e. brain activation and deactivation, in response to the straight leg raise test. So we do this before we randomize people into different groups. We do this twice in MRI 1. Then for six 20-minute sessions, they are either participating in a mindfulness meditation intervention, a deep breathing meditation intervention, or they listen to this really boring book called The Natural History of Cell Burn. And the question here is, can you use meditation immediately to reduce pain? Immediately. Let's say you injure yourself, you bend over to tie your shoes. Can you use this technique immediately to reduce pain? And so then we did it again. They come back into the scanner, and then we perform the straight leg raise test. And then we do it the second time, but this time we ask them to practice meditation. And of course, we collect their pain ratings after each of these maneuvers. So first, when people are lying down, this is on the y-axis, are their chronic back pain ratings. Supine is when they're lying down, and this is when they, after we perform the leg raise test, about 5 minutes after we put their leg down. What was remarkable to me was that these patients were sitting almost at a 4 out of 10 just from laying down without any kind of evocation. So they're always in pain. And we were able to successfully increase their pain by doing this maneuver by 30%. What did we find? In the brain, we found, and I won't bore you too much with this, we found basically all the regions that we would normally see activated during, let's say, painful heat or a pinprick or electrical stimulation in response to the straight leg raise test. For all those brain geeks out there, we see brain activation in the thalamus and in this region called the default mode network, which is associated with adding judgments about our sensory experiences, like appraising something. And in this case, they're appraising the feeling of pain, the ouch component. So on the y-axis is the change in pain. This is before the intervention. Blue is mindfulness meditation. Green is sham, the breathing. And the pink is the control group that listened to the book on tape. You can see we had this weird effect with the breathing meditation group where the change in pain was very low. But that's not as relevant as this. Here you could see both meditation techniques were effective at dramatically reducing pain, almost by 90%. So these are folks that were injured by us, or, you know, we evoke the pain, and then they were able to immediately use their meditation technique to reduce the pain. In our statistical models, mindfulness meditation was more effective when considering this drop than the rest of the groups at reducing this type of pain. Now, in the sham meditation group, the slow breathing group, there were no brain regions that were associated with pain relief. What was associated with pain relief was slower breathing. The slower you're breathing, the greater the pain relief in that slow breathing meditation group. But in the mindfulness meditation group, we saw something really cool. That network that was associated with self and adding judgments to your experiences, that was deactivated as shown in blue. As if they were no longer judging the experience, just like you were taught just now. Don't judge any distracting thoughts or feelings, emotions. Don't judge yourself. Don't judge the experience. Come back to the breath. And that is seemingly what they are doing. And this little red area is a brain region that corresponds to attending to the breath. We call it the primary somatosensory cortex. And it maps on exactly to the face, the nose, and the mouth. So it's almost, we have verification that they were truly attending to the breath. That was really cool. And I'm a brain geek. I still love it. This stuff's just amazing to me. Okay, so I want to move forward about some other people's work that have directly focused on older adults. And one fantastic aspect of studying aging is cellular aging. And in particular, the telomeres are these nucleotide sequences that are at the tips of our chromosomes, at the tips of our DNA. And they're considered to be this protective genetic material that stops cellular division from degrading, from weakening. However, when these guys get a little shorter, which they will with age, they naturally become shorter with age, they stop dividing so much and they cause cell death. And this cell death is explicitly related to aging and age-related diseases. So in particular, the short, and so like Alzheimer's, dementia, mild cognitive impairment, but also cardiovascular diseases and immune system dysfunctioning, all within these chromosomal endings, the telomeres. So my close friend and colleague, Alyssa Eppel, who's at UC San Francisco, ran a beautifully designed experiment. And she found that folks that had the highest stress levels exhibited the shortest telomeres. And she wrote this fantastic book, I highly recommend, The Telomere Effect. Those who practiced meditation ended up preserving the shortening of these endings on the chromosomes, and they ended up having longer telomeres and other healthier age-related markings. Then they did another experiment where they put people in a 3-month meditation retreat, because people have time to do that, I guess. I don't know. I don't know how that works, but that's amazing. And those who practiced in this retreat exhibited the highest level of increase in telomeres. So it's almost as if, I don't want to say you're reversing aging, but it's certainly protecting against some of the degeneration, that the chromosomal degeneration that we would see in natural aging. So that's something that was really exciting to see, because this work was explicitly focused on older adults. Also, what happens in our brain is a phenomenon called cortical thinning. Our brains become thinner with age. And that is considered a very natural part of our life. And this really becomes predominant during middle age and then gets exacerbated as we get older. This is atrophy. Just like a muscle gets atrophy, so does our brain. And in particular, the atrophy is most prominent in the prefrontal cortex, which is an area of the brain that's highly evolved, associated with controlling thoughts and feelings, and the hippocampus, which is critically involved in memory and, unfortunately, the development of memory-related diseases. So what we found, these researchers, Eileen Luders in Europe found, as well as Sarah Lazar at Harvard, was that meditation training buffered against this cortical thinning. People that practiced meditation had thicker brain regions, but Eileen's work found that there was this brain age, like how healthy your brain actually is in the context of performance and thickness and density, as compared to your chronological age. They randomized folks to these meditation interventions and found an exact opposite effect in folks that were not randomized to the meditation. Basically, there is no relationship between brain age and chronological age here in the control group, but brain age was much younger than chronological age in the meditators, suggesting that mindfulness meditation training can help offset this kind of age-related growth, aging, brain-related aging. And this work also with Sarah Lazar and Eileen Luders found that meditators had thicker brains than non-meditators, i.e. age-related cortical thinning wasn't as pronounced, and in some instances buffered against, age-related cortical thinning was buffered against, protected by practicing mindfulness meditation. And this is likely because the brain is more malleable. Not only is it just as malleable and changeable as a muscle, it's potentially more malleable than a muscle. And as we get older, our body muscles start to get thinner. We lose muscle mass and we get atrophy. And what do we have to do? We have to exercise. We have to work out. And we know that. And we can see that when we get older and we work out and we exercise, that we can kind of protect from this muscle loss. It's easy to see. But only since the recent inventions of MRI and other really cool technological advancements have we been able to see that the brain also becomes protected, stronger, bigger through mental training. So perhaps we should be putting the same amount of emphasis into mental training as we do into physical training, because the brain and the body are all very complex and multifaceted. Thus, the way that we can take care of ourselves is by also employing multifaceted interventions to promote well-being and healthy aging. I want to just say just a shout out to just some members of our laboratory. There are others that were part of the work that I showed. Most to all of the work has been funded by the National Institutes of Health, which we are so beyond grateful for allowing us to appreciate how mindfulness meditation works. And I just want to thank you so much for this gracious invitation to be here, as well as your time and attention during this presentation. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Dr. Zidane. That was fantastic. I think my most important takeaway is that I've got to convince my bosses to give me 3 months off so that I can go to a mindfulness and meditation retreat.
Yeah, me too. Good for them that they were able to do that. I'm sure they ate really well and they were in this wonderful setting. But, you know, a lot of our work has shown, not only my work, but other people's work, you don't need to be in a retreat setting. You don't need to be a monk. You don't need 3 months to start to see changes, as well as feel changes from practicing this technique.
Okay, fantastic. So with that, I'm curious, how would you describe the best way for people to get started in something like this if they don't have access to research studies like yours, or they're not going to settings where they maybe have the opportunity to do that, like a week-long retreat?
I thought you'd never ask. So there are so many free, reliable resources online. I would highly recommend the UC San Diego Center for Mindfulness. If you go to their website, there is a page there that has dozens upon dozens of audio and video recordings that you could stream and or download for free.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Guided instructions. They also, on their website, you can link up and where they have daily meditation practices on Zoom for free, where you can practice and ask questions directly to a teacher. Once you know the recipe, all you have to do is bake the cake every day. Mm-hmm. Or not every day. You could just do it a couple times a week. It doesn't matter. Or whenever you feel like you need to do it. The recipe is relatively easy. It's kind of just like going to the gym. You just got to get up and do it. Luckily, you don't have to spend 45 minutes or an hour in the gym for you to feel the benefits. I would say even 5 minutes is enough for you to potentially change the course of your day.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, that was going to be my next question. How much mindfulness practice is needed to notice any real changes in well-being? Is it more about consistency than duration?
Great question. So I think the first time you practice for 10 minutes, you're going to feel you're going to feel more relaxed. You're going to feel less anxious, less stress. And just like physical training, just like when you go work out in the gym, if you keep going at it, you start to feel a little bit stronger. You start to feel a little bit better. And so you get stronger and stronger and stronger. And then one day you wake up and you're just strong. The same is true with meditation. What we see in the folks that meditate for a long period of time is that they actually just wake up in a meditative state. They're always in that state. So it's really just like physical training, a use it or lose it principle. So you can feel better almost immediately. The more sustainable effects from this practice happen with greater training. The standard meditation intervention is 8 weeks, but from our data, a couple of weeks can really move the needle on how you feel and how you interact with our environment and how little or how you protect yourself from the daily stressors that arise in our daily lives.
That's great. Adding to that, I find that little things like in considering our daily lives, little things like if I'm at a stoplight and I'm running late, I can use my deep breathing exercises to be able to get through that and not panic as much. Or if I'm in a meeting that's really stressful, I mean, there's lots of different ways that you can sort of bring it into your everyday life in stressful situations.
Totally. And the whole thing's about awareness. That's right, Danielle. You just want to be aware, like, oh, I just got a little agitated because I need to stand in line for a long time, or someone cut me off on the 5. You know, some of these things that are just happened every day. And what meditation does is it helps you appreciate and become aware of when those reflexive emotions arise. Awareness is almost all of it. And when you see, when you feel that aggravation, when someone cuts you off or if you're sitting in traffic, that's when you can say to yourself, I just need to take a deep breath right now and reset myself. And that can really just do so much benefit for us.
Even when parenting or with our grandkids, right? Like if you find yourself getting really agitated, a few deep breaths can go a long way.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely. Okay. So here's a question about older adults and ADHD. So I'm not sure if this is your area so much, but we'll see. Do seniors with ADHD with and without medication therapy perform as well as seniors without a history of ADHD and mindfulness training? It's a great question.
That is a great question. And I really don't know if that work's ever been performed. But if you're on medication or you're not on medication and you practice mindfulness, you're going to be able to teach yourself how to be able to sustain attention without being distracted so easily. You're going to be able to pick up when your mind is being distracted. That's the hardest thing about distraction, is sometimes we can go on forever without realizing that we've been distracted. Like, oh, wait, that's been 15 minutes. I've been thinking about, you know, X, Y or whatnot. Right. So being able to be aware of that is critical so that you could do something about it. But that is a wonderful question. It makes me want to do an experiment that tests that.
Yeah, to be continued. Okay, how about this? Do you think mindfulness would improve the cognitive abilities of someone who's experiencing deficits due to a traumatic brain injury? Do you know anything about this area?
Yeah, so I haven't done work in this area. I believe it is woefully understudied. Sometimes what can happen with meditation, especially mindfulness meditation, and folks with TBI, the traumatic brain injuries, is that you can get frustrated very quickly. So you can get fatigued very quickly. And that's not anyone's fault, but the fact that the brain is reorganizing itself after a traumatic injury. So my suggestion would be to use that deep breathing meditation practice at first. You don't need to add a lot of attention to it. Eventually start adding on to that. But at first, you could just do slow deep breaths. And I didn't show you even a fraction of those data that show that that sleep deep breathing practice is highly effective at anxiety, depression, pain, you name it. So maybe start out slowly. Take a few jogs before you run a marathon, you know, and relax. And then slowly build yourself up by adding mindfulness-based instructions until you start feeling a place of balance. That's the biggest thing I would say, is that folks can feel really tired, fatigued, and frustrated at the early stages if they're trying to perform like a high intense mindfulness practice. So take it a step back, deep breaths, and then slowly build yourself up.
Yeah, that's nice. Practical advice. I like that. Okay. How about in your research studies, do you look at participants' diets, exercise, supplements, anything like this when you're looking at the outcomes?
Yeah, so we do ask those types of questions. And that's really for us to appreciate if one group is different than the other. Mm-hmm. But what we haven't done is run the analysis to see if those supplements or exercises are actually informing the meditation practice. That would be super cool. Now, I do have to say, it can't just be meditation that's going to make you age healthy. Okay. It has to be multimodal. You have to eat right. You have to surround yourself with good, positive people. You have to physically exercise and mentally exercise. It is a, and whether you're older or younger, it doesn't matter. It's the same recipe. So what I want to make sure is that, you know, our health isn't predicated by one pathway, you know, to well-being. And so we really want you to take the initiative to integrate as many pieces as possible. And unfortunately, in our society, mental training hasn't really taken that much prominence. And I think that's because there's just been a lack of evidence until, you know, recently.
Okay, that makes sense. Okay, here's a great question on exercise and meditation. Do you have any recommendations of meditate, exercise, meditate? Is there any research that says any specific order?
Or do it at the same time. So there's a couple of books out there on mindful running or mindful walking.
Yeah.
And right, so being in control of your breathing as you run or as you walk, you start to feel the interactions of your feet or the biomechanics of your legs as you walk. So integration of mindfulness, there's definitely a component of mindfulness in weightlifting where you can, this idea of mind-body connection that some work has shown can expand or increase or facilitate muscle growth through this connection. I would personally meditate first thing in the morning. If you keep practicing meditation, I have felt, and a lot of people's research has shown that you get more energy. And so that energy may not be beneficial for you to go to sleep at night. If you do want to practice a meditation at night, I would do that slow, deep breathing. That will definitely knock you out. Now, then I would go and run or lift weights. Or do, you know, yoga is meditation. Yoga just means union between mind and body. That's its literal translation. So yoga is a perfect example of the integration of a mindfulness practice with a physical exercise. But really, it's to your own, it's really your own preference. So this could be really fun for you to play around and see what works for you. And quite frankly, you know, it's raining in San Diego right now. It could all just depend on the weather, mood, the day of the week, how busy you are. So it's okay and to be flexible. And I don't think there's any research that has shown that one before the other is more beneficial.
Okay, fantastic. We did have a couple of questions about what time of day. So you answered that. Here's another great one. I hear this a lot. How do you keep from falling asleep while practicing mindfulness?
It's going to happen.
Guilty.
It's going to happen, especially if you're tired. And you're going to fall asleep. Your body needs it. You're actually, when you're sitting down to meditate, you're dedicating time to yourself. It's a wonderful gift. And so in that time dedication, your body is saying, I kind of need to take a nap. And that's going to happen. So this is why I do it in the morning. Because by 4 p.m., 5 p.m., I am cross-eyed zonked, okay? And so this is why I enjoy it in the morning, and it kind of sets the mood for the rest of the day. To help yourself not fall asleep, keep your eyes open. You can do a half gaze and just stare down at a target. You can keep your eyes half open and put your hand on your belly and feel the breath sensations occurring on your belly. And then when you start feeling a little bit more focused, a little bit more energized with the eye open practice, then you can begin to play around with your eyes closed. And just a little fun fact, Zen meditation, which is the type of meditation primarily practiced in Japan, it's all eyes open. And if you could fall asleep with your eyes open, you've got different problems.
Fantastic. Okay. Thanks for that. Okay. Here's a question. Have you included sound in your studies? Do you know anything about 40 Hz inducing gamma frequency? A little above my understanding.
I have. Okay. So answer one, no, we have not included sound in our experiments. So there is some work that shows that deep meditation states elucidates gamma wave synchrony. Gamma wave is one of the highest levels of attention as an electrophysiological marker of the brain. So the idea is that if you're listening to a high gamma wave, that can make it easier for you to get into a meditative state. That's the theory. I just don't know. I literally don't know if that has been empirically demonstrated, although I imagine at some level it has. I just don't know that literature very well, but it's definitely a fruitful endeavor if you want to experiment with it. Then you can get it on Spotify or whatever. They have these like different hertz that if you want to fall asleep, or if you want to concentrate, or if you want to, you know, reach enlightenment, you can do that with your, you know, with these audio recordings.
Okay, great. And so we have time for just about one more question. I'm curious, where do you see mindfulness research heading in the next 5 to 10 years? Are there emerging trends or exciting areas that you're particularly focused on or that you see the field going?
Well, I am particularly interested in studying the effects of mindfulness meditation in older adults. The work has been done by the likes of Sarah Lazar and Eileen Luders and Alyssa Eppel and others. I know I'm forgetting some, but I still feel like it's woefully understudied. I feel like there are conditions that we will suffer from as older adults that can potentially be assuaged or addressed by the practice of mindfulness meditation. So that's the first thing. And we're now also getting into different types of brain imaging techniques, body measurements that have not been studied in the integration of mindfulness meditation. So personally, I'd like to do more advanced neuroscience techniques to understand how mindfulness works in the brain, but also targeting older adults and as well as kids. I think that if we can train the mind to be present-centered at the earliest age possible, we may be able to buffer against some of the stress responses that naturally arise as we get older. And this world is getting more complicated by the day. And I don't feel like we've evolved in a way that can catch up with how fast the world is moving. Mm-hmm. So perhaps mindfulness can kind of keep us in the gear that we need to be in so that we could appreciate and maintain and regulate this changing world.
That's fantastic. Well, I am excited and honored that our Stein Institute will be playing a role in your work with older adults in the near future. Exciting. So that feels really exciting for us to be able to partner with you and do this work with older adults, I think is so important.
It's easily one of the most exciting projects that we have on our frontier. And I'm just so grateful that Danielle, you and Dr. Morant and Dr. Molinas and others at the Stein Institute, have taken that initiative to collaborate with us, and I can't wait to see what the results are.
Me too. I cannot wait. Well, with that, I want to just say thank you so much for your amazing talk today. I'm so appreciative of your time, your effort, and your dedication to this really important area. For all of you who attended today, thank you so much for your time. A reminder that this talk will be on UCTV and aired in the near future, and we'll be sure to send it out to all of you. If you want to learn more about what we're doing at the Stein Institute, you can find us at aging.ucsd.edu. And with that, thank you so much, Dr. Suzanne.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for your time and attention. I really appreciate it.
Okay, everybody have a great rest of your day.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.